I'm going to be talking today about a project called Carrot, which we've been doing at the AMP Lab in conjunction with some folks at the University of Helsinki. And this is aimed at doing collaborative energy diagnosis on mobile devices. So mobile is a hot topic. Sometimes this is literally a hot topic. So this is an article that I really love. It's a letter from some user of a mobile device who was complaining that their mobile device was getting hot in their pocket during a time when they suspected that it was supposed to be idle. So it should have been doing nothing, and instead it was both chewing up their battery and apparently getting uncomfortable. And of course, mobile is otherwise a hot topic because this year the number of mobile devices exceeds the number of people on the planet. So anyone who has any sort of smartphone or tablet has probably had a similar experience to the following. So you start out your day and your battery is fully charged, and then you do some work, well, maybe not immediately, and then your phone maybe sits idle for periods of time, maybe you actually get some work done, and then at some point you open up your phone and it says that you have low battery. And so as a user of one of these mobile devices, the questions that you want to answer are, why is the battery draining? You'd also like to know whether this battery use is normal. So if you were to use your phone in the same way tomorrow, should you expect to have similar results? And finally, if the battery drain is such that you can't use your device beyond lunchtime, then you'd also like to know whether there's something you can do about it, or is there some action that you can take as a user rather than as a device manufacturer or a developer to improve your battery life. So what I'll be talking about today is a project called Carrot, which aims to answer those three questions on the previous slide. Basically, what's using energy, is it normal, and what can I do about it? I'll describe the process that we use to take samples that we collect from a community of mobile devices and perform energy diagnosis on that data. I'll talk about some of the ways that we deal with uncertainty. There are lots of sources of uncertainty in the data that we look at, and I'll describe some of the statistical techniques that we use to deal with them. I'll describe the implementation, both on the front end and the back end, and then finally deployment of the Carrot apps on iOS and Android, which is currently have been installed on just shy of 500,000 devices. Okay, so let me just set the stage here, though, about what's been done previously in terms of energy diagnosis. So this is the entirety of previous work, to my knowledge. There's been some good work at the University of Purdue doing sort of ad hoc diagnosis of particular types of misbehavior on mobile devices. For example, they had a paper on what they called a no-sleep bug, and this was a violation of a particular locking discipline on Android that would prevent the screen from going to sleep when it otherwise should have. And so they had a technique that was designed specifically to detect whether or not this type of bug could potentially affect a particular app. Other approaches have been more intrusive, so they've required that you, for example, jailbreak the device or instrument the operating system, that you have access to the source code or the ability to instrument the app and so on, none of which we assume in this work. And then finally, if you have a mobile device, you've probably seen dozens at least apps on these various app stores that claim that they will, give you battery information and tell you how to improve your battery life and so on. And uniformly, they give you advice like, kill all of your background apps or just dim your screen. And basically what they're advising is that you use your device less. None of this is specific to your particular device, and frequently it's not even specific necessarily to what's actually using power on your device. So our approach looks like this. We use instead a collaborative approach. So we have the crowd, meaning a community of mobile devices, from which we collect instrumentation data and aggregate that in the cloud. We have an analysis that runs in a language called Spark, which was developed in the AMP Lab on AWS EC2 instances. And we store data in DynamoDB and S3. And then the results of this analysis, so these personalized reports for all of the mobile devices that are in this community that we're monitoring, we then return to the mobile devices. That's sort of what they get for participating in the Carrot project, is they get personalized energy debugging information. And I'll describe all of this throughout the talk. So to our knowledge, this is the first collaborative approach for diagnosing energy problems. So that's kind of neat, but it's worth discussing for a little bit why it matters that it's collaborative. So if you imagine that you had only a single mobile device, and I give you great power to instrument this mobile device in various ways, So you can modify the operating system. You can do very precise attribution of what's using energy, under what circumstances, and so on. And you get to run the device however many times you want. So you can even repeat an experiment and let some user interact with an app over and over again until you're sort of comfortable with what you've collected. It's still then nearly impossible to do certain kinds of diagnosis. So first of all, in between runs of this app, there may be features that you're not changing, some configuration variable or some user behavior that doesn't vary on this particular device. Certainly the device model won't vary from one run to another. And sometimes we found that that's actually one of the things that triggers misbehavior, that triggers these energy problems. And so given only a single device, it's nearly impossible to do some of the kinds of energy diagnosis that we do in this project. And some of the questions that are particularly difficult to answer are questions like, is this behavior normal? What is the trigger for a particular energy problem? How severe is it? So how much energy should I expect to save if I somehow modify the behavior of this app so that it no longer exhibits this misbehavior? And also, how frequent is it? So thinking in terms of triage. So if I'm a developer, I obviously have a long list of things that I'd like to fix on my app, and maybe some of them are energy related. You'd like to have some sense of whether this is just affecting one device or whether half of your users are experiencing these sort of energy problems. So without a collaborative approach, these things are extremely difficult and in some cases impossible. There are other advantages you get from taking a collaborative approach. One of those is that you can distribute instrumentation overhead. And this is something that you see in the literature in lots of different circumstances where people are able to, on any individual device, limit the amount of power or other resources that you need to consume for instrumentation purposes by instead spreading it out over a large number of devices. And finally, something that turns out to be very important for this kind of statistical work is compensating for biases and uncertainty. And I'll describe this later in the talk. So there are a couple of design goals when we approached this project. So the first thing that we said was that as a starting point, we wanted to take the most invasive method that we could do that would work both on Android and on iOS. So of course, iOS is kind of the limiting factor here in terms of how much you're able to do. And we decided to go for feature parity because the question here was whether or not there was some method that you could deploy on both of these that would enable you to do the kinds of diagnosis that we want. And so being eligible for Apple's App Store was essentially the constraint that we had to work under. And so this is, of course, what we accomplished. And the goal here, again, is to investigate how far we can take diagnosis when you don't have the ability to do more sort of invasive instrumentation and so on. So we developed an app that's for both iOS and Android that's called Carrot. I like to pause and explain the name. It's a triple pun, which I'm very proud of. It's one of the things I'm most proud of in the project. So if you'll see that the logo here is sort of like a carrot, C-A-R-R-O-T, but it has an orange diamond instead. And so the pun there is that carrot is C-A-R-A-T, is how you measure the size of a diamond, weight of a diamond. And then the third pun, of course, is that a carrot is also a unit by which you measure joules. As in energy. Okay. All right, I'm done indulging myself in that. Okay, so the goal of this app here is to do personalized energy debugging. So what this will tell you is what's misbehaving on your device, what's basically using a lot of energy, whether that use is normal, so is it just your device or is it all devices running this app, what you can do to improve your battery life, and then how much you should expect this to help. So these are some screenshots from different versions of the app. I guess the two on the right are from iOS, and the one on the left is from Android. So this first screenshot on the left here from Android is what we call the action screen. And this will tell you specifically things that you could do on your device that would improve your battery life. So in this case, Carrot knows that Evernote, Go Keyboard, and Speed Test are processes that are currently running on that particular mobile device. It further knows that Evernote and Go Keyboard seem to use a lot of energy on a large number of different mobile devices. And so if you're willing to stop using that particular app, then in this case, it says that you'll get another 31 minutes of battery life from killing Evernote and 25 minutes plus or minus 1 minute for killing Go Keyboard. And those plus or minus numbers have to do with the statistical certainty with which we're making these recommendations. We suggest restarting Speed Test because in this particular case, we found that on this device, Speed Test is using far more energy than on other similar devices that are running Speed Test. So we say this might be caught in a bad state, and there's some possibility that if you simply restart the app, it'll get out of that bad state and you can recover another 24 plus or minus 4 minutes of battery life. The top right image there is from the HOG screen. So HOGs, I'll describe later, are basically apps that seem to use a lot of energy across all devices. And this is just providing a list of what some of these HOGs are that this particular device has been shown to run in the past. So it's saying, you know, you can get another 31 minutes or 9 minutes and so on, depending on which of these you were to kill if they were to be running. And then on the bottom right, we have the device screen. And this gives you a sense of the kind of information that Carrot is reporting about your device to the analysis in the cloud. So it tells information about your OS version, your device model, what processes are running, your battery level, and so on. And of particular note is this thing on the top there called a J-score. So we included a J-score, which is essentially your percentile battery life relative to the community, because we wanted people to have a kind of single number that they could latch onto and get a sense of how their battery life compared with other people. And after we launched Carrot, we found that there were certain users who had really high J-scores and were very unhappy with their battery life, and vice versa. And there was something about finding out that their J-score was really low when they were very happy with their battery life that made them suddenly say, well, okay, I could actually be getting better battery life than I'm getting now. And they were sort of, their standards were too low somehow. And so it was interesting seeing kind of how this played out as people started to use it. Okay. So for those of you who are curious about trying Carrot, it's free on the App Store and the Google Play Store. And almost all of the sort of frustrated emails we got from users were because they didn't read the app description before they downloaded it, and they didn't read the splash screen when they first launched the app, and they didn't read the instructions within the app once they started using it. And so I'm putting them here just in case you use them to save you time later writing me an email. So the way it works is that you install Carrot on your device. You open it at least once a day for about a week, and this basically seeds the data that we have about your device so that we can start to generate reports that are personalized for you. And then at some point, about a week later, it will start to send you these reports. And when you open Carrot to the action screen, it will give you a list of things that you could do to save your battery life. And so you perform those actions if you feel like it, and then open it occasionally so you can get new actions. The key thing is that, especially on iOS, we're not allowed to run as a proper background process. And so we have to perform various tricks to get any sort of processing time to take samples. And so one of the consequences of this is that if you don't open Carrot every now and then it just won't be running and we won't get any more data from you. But when we were first developing Carrot, there were expressions of privacy concerns by some of the people who were working on it and some of our beta testers. And so we took a lot of pains to make sure that we were very clear about exactly what data was being collected, both prior to installation and when you first launch it. There's nothing personally identifying, so even if all of our data were to be publicly leaked, no one would be able to figure out which data set is specific to you. And all of the sample data, as I showed you, is actually displayed within the app, so you know exactly what we're collecting. We spent a lot of time trying to make sure that we adhered to various kinds of privacy concerns. It turns out, in retrospect, that it was more just a pain for us and that users were more than happy to give us tons of personal information once we started a dialogue with them over tech support. Both of the apps, the Android and the iOS apps, are open source. They're available on GitHub under a free BSD license. The analysis code on the back end is still proprietary. But you can go to the project homepage, carrot.cs.berkeley.edu, and you can find links to the GitHub there, or a link to the GitHub there. And if you are so inclined, if you find Carrot useful, or if you're interested in it, feel free to help us fix any bugs that you find. Yeah, that's never happened. Okay. But I like saying it anyway, just in case. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about how Carrot takes samples on the device and uses this, or on devices in general, and how it uses this to build a diagnosis. So on any individual mobile device, at various times, it's able to take samples. And these, a particular sample will have information like the timestamp. It will tell the battery level. It will include a process list, which will give a sense of which apps are currently running. And it will include various features like, do you have Wi-Fi access? Are you running iOS 5.1? And so on. And of course, we don't get a single sample from a device. We get multiple samples over time. And different features of the device can change. So as you can see, the battery level is depleting over time. Maybe they stopped using Keynote at some point and started using the Kindle app. Wi-Fi access may have been intermittent and so on. Sometimes there certain features are more static than others, so the OS version is more static than the Wi-Fi access, which in turn is more static than the device model. And so what we're going to do is take two consecutive samples where the battery was depleting, so T1 and T2. T2 sample came right after T1 and has less battery than the T1 sample, and there were no intermittent events that would say that it was charging, and so this is basically a period of time during which the battery was just depleting. And what we're going to do from this is compute a conditional distribution, a conditional rate distribution of battery drain. So we look at the difference in the timestamps, we look at the difference in the battery levels, and build a ratio out of this. And then we look at the sets of features of both of these two samples, and we combine them in a way that I won't talk about today to get this conditional discharge rate. So what this is saying is that under these circumstances, these particular two samples are telling us that we see this kind of battery drain. And of course, we're going to have lots of these, and so in the end, we're going to be building a distribution of these. So what we get is an energy rate drain probability distribution given some feature f. And what we're going to use these distributions for, one of the things we do, is look for energy anomalies. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page, the peaks in this distribution are saying that that type of energy drain rate is more likely given that you're in this regime where feature F is true, whatever features that might be. And so just to be concrete about that, let's say that feature F is that you're running Facebook. So given that you're running Facebook, this is the probability distribution of what sort of energy drain you should expect to see. So one of the things we can do is compare this with the distribution that you would see when you're not running Facebook. And so if you see this kind of pattern where running Facebook or whatever app uses far more energy statistically than when you're not running that app, we call this an energy hog. And I'll say in a minute what I mean by significantly more energy. So this is an energy hog, running an app versus not running an app. But you could also look at running an app on a particular user's device. So this is Jan, who is one of the project faculty leads. And let's say that we're looking at Facebook running specifically on his device. And let's say we get a distribution that looks like this. And obviously these are cartoon distributions. I'm just for visibility. And so one thing that I could look at is, rather than Facebook or not Facebook, Facebook on Jan's device and Facebook on other devices. Okay? So the key observation here is if we didn't have the crowd, there'd be no way to say whether Facebook running on Jan's device is normal for Facebook. But given that we do have a community of devices, we can instead compare Facebook running on other devices, those that are not Jan's. And so again, if we get this distribution that is significantly higher running on Jan's device than running on other devices, then we call this an energy bug. Okay? And this is the two of the types of anomalies that we look for, hogs and bugs. So rather than compare the original distributions, which I've been describing so far, we can get a little bit more mileage out of this data if instead, so what I've been saying so far is we have some subject distribution and a reference distribution. And we're comparing the expected values of these distributions and looking at the distance between it. But we like to know something about that distance, because both of these distributions were built by taking samples of energy use under various conditions. And so there's some uncertainty associated with the expected value of the reference distribution and the expected value of the subject distribution. And so instead of looking at the original distributions, we're actually going to look at the distributions of the expected values. So now on the x-axis, instead of the energy rate, we have the expected energy rate. It turns out mathematically that these are both normally distributed, so you get these nicely behaved distributions. And the expected values of these two distributions are the same as the expected values of the original distributions, but there are properties related to, so again, the expected value is the same, but there are properties related to the variance of this distribution that allow us to say something about our uncertainty. This is how we get our error and confidence intervals. So we can look at this distribution and we can say this is the expected value, but it's plus or minus some error e, which would be half the width of this these two outer lines that I just drew, percent per second battery drain rate with 50% confidence. And if I wanted a higher confidence level, if I wanted, say, 95% confidence, then I can expand this and in exchange get a higher error. So now it's plus or minus some larger error e, but now it's with 95% confidence. What that basically means is that there's only a 5% chance that this difference that we're describing is outside of the bounds that we've stated. So in addition, we'd like to kind of get a sense of what influences these confidence factors. So mathematically, there are only two things that affect these error and confidence bounds. The first is the variance of the original distribution. The second is the size of the crowd, basically how much data do we have. So if you decrease the variance or increase the size of the crowd, or both, then you decrease your error bars, meaning you become more confident in the data that you've collected and the diagnosis that we're stating. And similarly, if you increase the variance of the original distribution, if there's more spread, or if you have less data, then your error bars get bigger. So as we collect data, typically what will happen is that the original distribution will converge, so the variance will be decreasing, and of course we're getting more data. And so over time, as we collect more data, these error bars tend to shrink. And I'll show you some real data about how this actually happens in practice. So I said before that there's some notion of whether a difference between one distribution and another is significant. And of course, we're comparing these normal distributions of the expected battery drain that I described earlier. And there are a lot of symbols here, but essentially what you should get a sense of is we've taken these two distributions where we know the error and confidence bounds. So we can say, let's say we're looking for 95% confidence. We'll draw the error bars on both of these. And now the question is whether the distance between this one error sort of error range and the other error range is positive, if there is a gap between these two distributions with 95% confidence. And if there is that d prime that I've drawn in the middle, if that's positive, then we say that one is significantly greater than the other with whatever confidence bounds we said, say 95%. And that's what we'll use throughout the talk. So in addition to quantifying our confidence, we'd also like to improve it. And one of the ways that we can do this is to classify the data, essentially split up the data in various ways. So you could imagine, for example, that this feature that we're splitting on could be the device model. So we might say we're just going to look at iPhone 5 versus not iPhone 5, or Galaxy 2S versus not Galaxy 2S, and so on. And in performing one of these splits and dividing up our data like this, we always decrease the size of the crowd. We're always decreasing the amount of data we had. And we know from the previous slides that this increases our uncertainty. So our error bars get bigger whenever we do one of these splits. And so the only time that it's profitable to do a split like this is if the resulting distributions have less variance. And this will happen when this feature versus not this feature have significantly different energy behaviors. So if a particular app, say, is using far more energy on one OS version than on another OS version, then performing this classification, even though it decreases the amount of data in each of these split distributions, decreases the variance significantly enough that we actually can say more confidently what a diagnosis is. So we can build these kinds of classified diagnosis trees. And I won't describe in too much detail the process here. But the point is that by performing these splits over a series of different features, we can make diagnoses of the form, killing some app A will give you X plus or minus E minutes of battery life with 95% confidence, as would, for example, upgrading the OS to some version V. And so we've been able to build diagnoses on the back end that say things like, if you turn on your Wi-Fi, then you'll be able to save this amount of energy for this particular app on your device, and so on. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about how we deal with uncertainty. And there are various forms of uncertainty here, as you might imagine. If you've ever done anything with iOS or Android development, you know that there are lots of sources of uncertainty. So one thing that I'll talk about first is doing these battery measurements on iOS. So when we were first starting the project, we were looking at the battery API and doing some experiments, and we discovered that there's a particular notification on iOS that you can subscribe to called the battery level change notification. And this gets triggered at 5% intervals. And when this gets triggered, it will sort of tell Carrot, hey, there was a battery level changed event, and the new battery level is this. And in our experiments, this seemed to agree, the measurement that it reported seemed to agree with the actual measurement. But under all other circumstances, at any other time that you ask the iOS API what the battery level is, If it tells you, so the first one will give you, if it says 85, it's 85. But the second one, if it tells you under any other circumstances, if it tells you 85%, it could be between 85% and 5% lower than that value. Okay, and so essentially what it does is it can it will round up to the nearest 5% increment. And so it'll say, you know, 100, 100, 100, 95, 95, 95, 95, 90, 90, 90. So when we first discovered this, we were concerned that it might be a showstopper. And so the key here was to try to figure out some way that we could deal with this source of uncertainty. And so the way what we did was we built a prior distribution that was based on the measurements about which we were certain. And then we used this to decrease the uncertainty that we have about all the remaining measurements. And I'll show you how we do this. So we've built this prior distribution, which is essentially the energy drain rate distribution that we got only using the battery level changed measurements. So these are the measurements where we believe that there is very little uncertainty about what's actually going on. And now we run the, you know, Caret's running as usual, and you're up on the top here, we now have a plot of the actual battery percent in blue over time. So it's discharging, and then at some point maybe it's charging for a while, and then discharging again. And at various points during this execution, Caret is taking samples. So the X's here represent samples that we throw away because the battery was charging. It tells us nothing about energy use. And the green dots are samples that we're going to hang on to. And so let's look at a pair of these green dots, which we'll assume do not come from a battery level changed event. Now the green dot represents the value that the API told us. So it said 85%. And this black bar hanging down is the range in which the true level of the battery could lie. So this could hang down as far as 5%. Now we know then that given these two samples and that range of uncertainty, that the true rate of discharge could be as high as X, meaning the high end of the first and the low end of the second, or as low as Y, the low end of the first and the high end of the second. Now, that puts bounds on the lowest and the highest energy discharge rate that could have actually happened given what the API reported to us. And so what we do with that is we take that X and Y, those two bounding rates, and we take a slice of this a priori distribution. So we take a slice of this prior. So it could be no less than Y, no more than X. And from this, we get a new probability distribution. And that probability distribution we use as the rate for these two samples. And so anytime we have uncertain measurements, we do this process of taking a slice of the prior, and we're able to get a much more accurate view of how energy is actually being drained. And I'll show you experiments later on that show that we actually get quite accurate view of how energy is being used. In fact, I'll talk about it right now. So we did some ground truth experiments. Of course, we're doing all this sort of statistical trickery, and a question that you want to know is whether this reflects reality. And so we bought various devices like this Monsoon power meter and some hardware to hook up an iOS device and also an Android device to do some experiments with actual power metering, so really getting how many amps are being consumed under the following conditions and so on. You can see on the bottom right here, this is a picture of the rig that we had to come up with to get the, I think it was an iPhone 4S, hooked up to the Monsoon power meter. As will surprise none of you, Apple devices are not set up for soldering things onto the insides of. So this took a lot of finagling before we finally got it to work. And also there were various questions as to exactly how to do this. The folks at Monsoon were pretty fantastic about giving us the information that we needed to do this. This is a picture that they drew and then scanned and then emailed to us that was explaining how you would actually hook up the iPhone 4S to the power monitor. I know in the picture it looks like it's a calculator running Windows or something, but this was for the iPhone 4S. And so they were actually telling us, you know, this is what sort of resistor you're going to need and what sort of capacitor and all this sort of other stuff. So it was a really helpful bunch of people that helped us get these things hooked up. So the iPhone 4S got hooked up to a Monsoon power meter. And we partnered with a battery company called Leyden Energy, which is based in the South Bay. And they have a whole bunch of testing equipment. They mostly focus on Android devices. So they have various devices that they can plug these phones into and then run through usage scripts and get extremely accurate measurements about how energy is being used on these devices. And so they agreed to help us out with some experiments on Android devices. And so one of the things we used was a Galaxy Tab 2 10.1, and they got us the data that we needed under various usage scripts. So each of these are 8 hours or so of activities like browsing the internet, playing a game, letting the phone sit idle, turning on and off Wi-Fi, and things like that. And so essentially the sorts of things that we were seeing that our users were doing. Okay. So the first thing that I'll show you is that actually the battery measurements that we were getting were pretty close to the actual power usage. So the uncertainty that we were getting from the carrot samples using this prior distribution is actually pretty close in terms of an absolute amount to the actual battery level as measured either by the on-screen battery indicator, which you'll notice on iOS has 1% granularity, not 5%, as in the API that we have, the public API gives us less granularity than what we know they are actually calculating. And so you have four things here. The on-screen battery indicator, which is the teal thing. The carrot samples, and this is after we've computed with the prior distribution, meaning compensated for that uncertainty. And then the two different power monitor experiments. So one where you have carrot running, and then one instead where you have the weather app running. And I'll explain why we did that in a second. And all you really need to get from this graph is that in general, these are fairly close. But we don't actually care about the absolute level. What we really want to know is the rate of battery drain that we're estimating under various conditions, does that actually match reality? And so here's another picture based on real data. This is smoothed a little bit just so it's easier to see. It's a little bit jagged. But the black and the green are the power monitor measurements when you go through the script and carrot's running, or you go through the script and carrot is not running. And you can see that they overlap completely. So I'll say this on a later slide, but essentially the amount of energy that carrot uses over the course of this 8-hour usage script is in the noise. So we weren't, running the script without carrot actually used more energy than running with carrot. So this was within experimental uncertainty. And then this orange thing that you see is the estimated energy rate distribution by taking the carrot samples and estimating what we get for a distribution. And so quantitatively, we were only off by a very small amount in terms of the expected value of this distribution. On Android, we were off by 0.00015% per second, and a little bit more on iOS. And the thing to note about this is that over the course of, say, the iOS experiment, for example, carrot took 9 samples, and the power monitor took tens of thousands of samples. I think more than that, actually. I think it was hundreds of thousands of samples. I think every 2 milliseconds, over 8 hours, it was taking measurements. So it's a lot of measurements versus 9 measurements that carrot was allowed to take. And that's how far off we were in terms of the energy distribution, in terms of the expected amount of energy drain. Okay, so this is quite good. And it's only possible because we were doing clever statistics. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the overhead of carrot is extremely low. It was less than our experimental imprecision. And when we ran this standard weather app instead of carrot, it drained 3.5% more of the battery than when we ran carrot. Okay, so now I'll spend some time talking a little bit about the implementation. So I mentioned earlier that this is what the infrastructure looks like. You have the crowd with the devices that have been instrumented with carrot, and by instrumented, I just mean they installed an app, a user-level app. You don't have to jailbreak your phone or anything to run carrot. And in fact, we're not allowed to make a distribution of the carrot app that, at least on iOS, that runs on jailbroken phones because Apple could revoke our developer license. Okay, so. Then this data that we collect on the crowd gets reported to the analysis, which is implemented in Spark, as I mentioned, running on EC2 instances, and then gets stored in DynamoDB and S3 for various reasons. There are advantages and disadvantages to each of these storage formats, and so there are various reasons why we use both currently. So those of you who aren't familiar with Spark, this is a cluster computing framework that was developed in the AmpLab. One of the distinguishing characteristics of Spark is this thing called resilient distributed datasets, or RDDs. So these are in-memory data structures that are read-only. And the idea here is that, so one of the reasons that this came about is that, let's say you were doing a sort of MapReduce computation. You would finish the computation, and then all that stuff would get flushed from memory, and then you would want to run it again. But this is basically an iterative computation, so you just end up pulling all of that data back into memory so that you can iterate on it and so on. And so one of the reasons this came about is that you actually wanted to keep this information in memory so that you could iterate on it and basically sort of run over time and get the advantage of the fact that it stays resident. And so the framework does things like pays attention to where you ran previous computations using which data and so on, and supports all of the sort of parallel operations that you would expect in a sort of MapReduce type framework, but it also allows a more general a graph computation. So it's not just map and reduce. You can also do arbitrary DAGs. So in general, this is meant for iterative or interactive workloads. So it's a cool language. There's also a new project called Streaming Spark, which is meant for computations that are more streaming in nature. And they're both pretty cool. And I encourage you to check them out if you're not familiar with them. So this gives you a sense of how the computation of going from rates to building these distributions happens. So essentially what we do is we first compute these rate RDDs from the individual sample pairs. And this turns out to be pretty important to decrease some of the dependencies in the data that we had. So if you imagine three consecutive samples, the middle sample will be important for both of the rates on either side of it, or the rates on either side. And so to get rid of this, we kind of convert it into rates first, and then now each of these rates are an independent unit of information. And so they can move around to wherever we need them. And so we use these to compute these conditional distributions that I've been talking about throughout the talk, and we get a lot of the advantages of the Spark parallelism, and I'll show you some data, experimental data of what sort of advantage this actually gives us. And these are all operations that you're probably pretty familiar with, map and reduce and group by and so on. Just to give you a sense of how scalable the approach is, this is a plot of the server traffic shown in the teal as we increase the number of clients. And this is data from pretty early on in our lifetime, so this is before we launched on the various app stores and so on. And on the y-axis here, you have the bandwidth. So this was at our first tier server. What sort of traffic were we seeing? So it's far less than a byte per client per second. So we're able to support a pretty large community with very few servers. Any individual client is not reporting a very large amount of data. This gives a sense of how much the parallelization helps us. So on the x-axis, you have the number of samples, and the time is on the y-axis. So shorter is better. The serial implementation are these red boxes, I guess. And the Spark, as you can see, is much, much faster. It's also, you should note, significantly faster than the number of machines that we were running on, which was 20 in these experiments. So even if you just went from serial to a sort of naive 20-node parallel implementation, you shouldn't expect to see these sorts of speed-ups. And the reason that it gets so much better is that you're also getting all sorts of in-memory and caching effects thanks to the clever stuff that Spark is doing with memory management. So this is a very good parallelization result. And so it's even better than the fact that it was embarrassingly parallel, as I said. You're also getting lots of these nice memory behaviors. OK, so I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about the deployment. So initially, we used something called the Test Flight Over the Air Beta. I'm just curious, how many of you have ever used Test Flight or something similar? OK, cool. So Apple has various restrictions on how you can distribute apps to their devices, not via the App Store. So essentially, you have to register every individual device with Apple, and then build a provisioning profile that you then compile, and then compile the app specifically for, and then distribute to that device. And so services like Test Flight are designed to streamline this process so it's slightly less painful. So you can have people sign up through a web form, and then you just can download the provisioning profile for all of the people who have signed up for this beta. So initially, this was how we were deploying the iOS version of Carrot. We had about 100 people sign up because this was the limit imposed by Apple. Of those 100 people who signed up, we had 75 of those actually install it. This was kind of frustrating because Apple does not allow you to recycle the unused slots, so we couldn't take those 25 people who had signed up and not installed and remove them and then add new people. So we were just capped at 75 installs until we got into the App Store. So that was lovely. And we collected about 10,000 samples in this period of time. So we were over about 2 weeks, we got 10,000 samples. And even just given this small amount of data, so 75 users, a few thousand samples, we were able to find 35 apps that exhibited energy bugs. And these included popular apps like Facebook, Kindle, and Flipboard. And for all of these, we were able to find corroborating evidence in the form of things like forum posts or news articles or data correlations that we were able to verify. And I'll talk about a couple of these in a minute. We also did some bug or anomaly injection experiments. So we took the Wikipedia mobile app, which is open source, and we wrote some misbehaviors into the app that we could trigger on command. And so these would do abuse various resources like the CPU or the GPU or I think the radio. And might have been Wi-Fi. At any rate, so we injected these three bugs at various times. And so we had Wikipedia mobile installed on most of the clients in this community. And we took one particular device and we gave it the buggy version of Wikipedia. And then one day we triggered the CPU bug, and then another day we triggered the GPS bug, and then another day we triggered the third one, and so on. And so in every case, Carrot would come up and say, hey, it looks like Wikipedia mobile is a bug on your device. And on none of the other devices did it say that Wikipedia mobile was a bug. So in other words, this was a no false positives, no false negatives result for this injection experiment. So this was very encouraging. This was only, again, 75 users. And a lot of the time when people say, oh, it's a collaborative method or something, they imagine that you're going to need, you know, millions of devices to make it work. And a few dozen was fine for detecting these sorts of misbehaviors. And then, so we got onto the App Store, and then a couple of days later, we got featured on TechCrunch. And we had provisioned everything on the back end, thinking that we were going to have to, you know, go and like push our friends and say, you know, please install this. We really need the data. I want to, you know, get some research results and so on. And so we had planned for maybe having 1 to 10,000 users on the high end. 10,000 was like our pie in the sky number. And so we got featured on TechCrunch, and within 24 hours, we saw ourselves on several dozen other news sources. So we were on Lifehacker. We were the Gizmodo app of the day, and so on. And it went on like this, and 24 hours after the TechCrunch article went live, we had more than 100,000 users. So by the time I woke up the next morning, we were an order of magnitude above the high end that we had planned to scale to. 24 hours after that, we had 200,000 users, and now we have over 450,000 devices, about 60% of which are iOS and 40% on Android. And tens of millions of samples from these devices. So this is far and away larger than we ever expected the project to grow. One of the only reasons that we were able to scale at all was because we had the back end deployed on a cloud service. So if we had built our own provisioned cluster in the AMP lab, we would have outgrown it within a day of having launched. Okay, so being able to just launch more EC2 instances when we wanted to run the analysis on more data, or being able to increase the number of servers on the front end that we were load balancing to was absolutely crucial to being able to survive this sort of explosion. Which is not to say that we handled it with aplomb. We had all sorts of growing pains in terms of trying to scale several orders of magnitude that quickly. But the fact that we could do it at all, we were pretty excited about. So this was a lot of devices, and that's the state of the project. So on all these devices, we've detected more than 11,000 hogs, and this may sound like a lot of apps being hogs, but it's actually only about 9.4% of all of the ones that we saw. So there are actually quite a lot of apps that people run, and only about 10% of them are perceived as being hogs, meaning they use significantly more energy than all of the rest of the apps. And sometimes these will include ones that you would expect, like Pandora and Skype. So these are apps that use various resources rather heavily, and so you'd expect them to fall into the category of hogs. But we also found a number of hogs that at least I would not have expected to be hogs. So on Android, I don't use an Android device, but I wouldn't have expected a wallpaper, for example, to be one of the top hogs. And actually, there were two wallpaper apps that showed up in the top 10 hogs on the Android platform, which surprised me. There were also a family of airline apps, so the sort of thing where you would search for airfares and make reservations and so on. And there was a whole family of them that showed up in, it was at least the top 50 or so on iOS, and they were clearly all developed by the same developer who, I guess, had no sensitivity toward what sort of energy was being used on their by their app. We also found a large number of buggy instances. So an instance here is an app paired with a particular user. So that's basically just a little bit more than one app per user if they were evenly distributed. So not very many energy bugs, only 5.3% of the maximum possible, given the data that we have. And these included things like Kindle and Facebook and YouTube. So again, what this means, when we say that there's a buggy instance, we mean that YouTube running on certain users' devices consumes far more energy than on other users' devices. And in fact, it further says that actually YouTube is not a hog. So compared with all the apps that you could possibly get, I think this was on iOS, with all the apps you could download on iOS, YouTube is not using significantly more energy than the average app, which was surprising to me. So let me show you an example of one of the bugs that we found. And we found, as I mentioned, a whole lot of them. So this was Kindle running on iOS. This was from several months back, so this bug has since been fixed. Kindle, if you're not familiar with it, is an ebook reader. So this synchronizes with your Kindle device and various other devices that are able to read Kindle media. And on 3.9% of the iOS clients that were running this Kindle app, they were using significantly more energy than all of the other ones. Okay. And we did some investigation. We discovered that there was apparently a bug in the WhisperSync protocol. This is the protocol that the app uses to synchronize your data, meaning your books and your annotations and bookmarks and so on, across your different Kindle devices. And it turned out that when Wi-Fi was unavailable, this protocol would use an order of magnitude more energy than when Wi-Fi was available. So this is, as I said, has since been fixed. But we were able to confirm this in our data. So these clients, these 3.9% of clients that were seeing this much greater energy drain, all had the property that they didn't have their Wi-Fi turned on when we saw this high energy drain. And so the diagnosis that you'd come up with here is that you should turn on Wi-Fi. And in this case, it would give you a 36-minute improvement. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you can get 36 more minutes just by turning on your Wi-Fi, then that's pretty good. And it also is sort of counterintuitive to me. I would have thought that turning on Wi-Fi would consume more energy rather than less. And this is an example of one of these diagnosis trees that I showed you that we build earlier, just to give you a sense of some of the kinds of information that we can get. So this is without Kindle would be running the average of all the other apps. You can get about, on this particular device, about 7.7 hours. If you were to run Kindle, you'd actually get 8.4 hours. So what that means, in other words, is that Kindle uses less energy than a typical app. So it's not a hog, which one would expect. It's just displaying text. But that actually the type of network connectivity you have, if you go one level further down in the tree, matters a lot in terms of how much energy you're going to be using. If you have the network turned off, then it doesn't even try to synchronize, and you can get 12 and a half hours of reading on this device when you're running Kindle. If you do have connectivity, however, it's going to be trying to do this synchronization. And at the time, this was a pretty inefficient process, and it was more inefficient on 3G than on Wi-Fi. So another example of a bug was on the Twitter app. So this was on Android. I assume you're all familiar with Twitter. It's a microblogging app. It was buggy on just under 15% of the Android clients that were running Twitter. The MCAD, which is that diagnosis tree that I showed you, actually implicated the operating system version. There was a particular version, point version, of the Android operating system on which the Twitter app was using significantly more energy than on other versions. So and Wi-Fi also helps a little bit, but it was mostly just this operating system version. And actually, if you upgraded to Ice Cream Sandwich 404, you get 94 minutes more battery life when using the Twitter app. So this was pretty spectacular. I was really surprised by this result. But the data backed it up, and it agreed with one of our users played with it a little bit on an earlier version, and it did actually seem to drain the battery noticeably faster without the operating system being upgraded. And so this is interesting because it's purely environmental. So if you were just trying to do this diagnosis on a single device and didn't think, hey, well, I should try to upgrade the operating system, then you would never have figured out that it wasn't just the Twitter's an energy hog, that actually this was a bug that you could do something about. You could take some action, in this case, upgrading the operating system. And an hour and a half is significant. Okay, so does Carrot actually improve battery life? This is one of the metrics that you presumably would care about if you're a battery improvement app. And so we found that our users, if we look at the day since they get their first report, meaning they run it for about a week, gathering that initial data set, they get their first report, and then we look, we say, okay, that his battery life at this point is as follows, and now we're gonna track their battery life over time since that first report. And we found that after 10 days, the average user, the user would see an average of 10% battery life improvement, and after 90 days, it would be about a 30% improvement. So 30% more battery life just by having an app tell you this particular app you should try restarting, this particular app that you should kill, and so on, is pretty significant. And just anecdotally, and I don't have any numbers for this, it is not the case that users would just kill everything, and that's why they're starting to see these improvements. They were targeting the specific apps that Carrot was recommending that they kill, and that was sufficient to get this sort of benefit. So I mentioned earlier that as we get more data, the error and confidence bounds become tighter and tighter. We become more and more confident in the diagnoses that we're given, more confident in the number that we're providing as far as how much expected improvement they should see and so on. And so this gives you a sense of how that convergence happens in practice. You'll see that it actually converges quite quickly. So after 2,048 samples, I should explain what's going on here. So the sample count is on the x-axis and the relative expected value and error on the y-axis. So the black is indicating the expected value that's estimated given that number of samples. And then the dashed lines above and below are the error bounds, the 95% confidence error bounds. And you can see that as we collect more data, these converge rather quickly. And as I said, we have tens of millions of samples now. And so having converged after only a few thousand means that we don't need many people to run a particular app before we can start making diagnoses associated with them. Another thing that you might care about is the prediction accuracy. So we've said that if you upgrade to Ice Cream Sandwich 404 and you're using Twitter, then you should see 94 minutes more battery life, plus or minus some bounds. And you'd like to know, in practice, do people actually see improvements within those error bounds that we've provided? And so this is for a particular hog, and unfortunately I actually forgot which hog we were looking at here. But we looked at several hundred users that were running this particular hog, and we looked at how frequently they were running this app. So rather than either running it all the time or running it never, which would give you that full expected improvement, they might run it 60% of the time and then reduce that to 40%, and you'd expect to see a fraction of the total battery life improvement. And so what this is essentially saying is that if the closer you are to that green line, the more accurate we were in terms of predicting how much battery life improvement you would see by taking a particular action. So this is kind of a messy graph. I actually haven't found a good way to display this data. The high bit is written on the bullet above it, which is that 95.4% of these predictions that we made were within the 95% confidence bounds, which is, of course, what we want. If it were less than 95%, then they wouldn't have been very good 95% confidence bounds. So in other words, most users were seeing the kinds of improvements that we were predicting they would see when they took the actions that we advised them to take. So that, again, is a pretty nice result. Of course, another data point that you might care about is, do users actually enjoy the app? Do they like it? Are we getting positive feedback? Obviously, if you have 500,000 users, you also get plenty of negative feedback. But anecdotally, based on some of the comments that we've gotten from people, they really do like it. And these are just a couple that I pulled out that I happen to like especially. One person said, I've been measuring my battery with and without its Carrot's recommendations for the past month, and I'm getting about 32 to 48 extra minutes of battery life from my phone. And what I find interesting about that is it's an extremely specific number, right? This is not a person who's just saying, you know, oh, I'm seeing, you know, half an hour to an hour more battery life. You get the impression that this is someone who is really measuring the improvement that they're seeing from this app, which I appreciated. And then the second to last person absolutely loves the app and finds it very twice useful. The other person loves the app, though not absolutely, but it's very three times useful. So a lot of excited people. Basically, the comment that we see pretty frequently is that this is giving users information that they don't have the ability to get via any other channel. There are no other apps that do what Carrot does. Okay, so I'm going to spend a few minutes now just giving you a little bit of information about how the Carrot project fits in with the vision of the AMP Lab. And also, you may have noticed on the title slide that I had two affiliations under my name, and I'll talk a little bit about that second hat. So this is the diagram that I think I've shown you three times now, which is the architecture behind Carrot's collaborative diagnosis approach. But this is a sort of approach that you've seen in other contexts before. So the Google model says, you know, okay, well, the crowd is actually going to be people making web pages. They're going to be writing down information, taking samples in the form of the link structure of the internet. And you're accumulating this database on the back end of saying, you know, A links to B. And they use the PageRank algorithm to then provide users with a service, which is search. And so you have this feedback loop of the crowd is providing some data that allows some back-end service to then provide them information. And of course, the back-end service benefits, but the point is that the crowd gets some feedback for the effort that they're taking. And this is notably different than some of the other crowd models that you see, like Mechanical Turk, for example, where the user would be getting back 5 cents instead of some service. Another place you've seen this is on Facebook. So users provide personal data, like A is friends with B, and then Facebook gives them this social platform that enables various things that Facebook enables, like farming and stuff. And so this also fits into the same sort of collaborative model of providing a service to the crowd in exchange for some information, some data. And at the AMP Lab, we have a large number of projects that are trying to essentially define and build this layer, this interface between the crowd and big data. So the goal here is to build tools and methodologies that will extract data and computation from the crowd and then extract that value from the big data and provide it back to the crowd. Okay, so this is sort of where a lot of the projects of the AMP Lab sit, and obviously it's where Carrot sits as well. Now, I mentioned at the beginning, again, that I also wear another hat, which is for Kuro Labs. So Kuro Labs is a startup that we're spinning off based on some of the technology behind Carrot that we developed. It's not an exaggeration to say that Kuro Labs barely exists at this point. We are just in the very, very first stages of doing this. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what some of our plans are and what's going on, just because I'm excited about it, and this I have a microphone, so. Here we go. So again, this is the same sort of picture you've seen before, where Carrot is running inside of the crowd. One of the next steps that we're working on doing here is building a developer API. So if you develop mobile apps, and we've had developers contact us basically saying, we don't have any good tools for understanding how our app is using energy in the wild. But we have all of the analysis infrastructure in place to help them answer these sorts of questions. And so we're working on building a developer API so that you could, you know, like with Flurry or one of these other instrumentation tools, just add a line or two into your app, recompile with our library, and then deploy it as you normally would. And what will happen is you'll report all this data in the same way that Carrot collects data. But now we can start to say things about what's going on internally inside of your app that Carrot currently is not able to see. So for example, in-app configurations and user behaviors, those are opaque to Carrot, especially on iOS. There's no ability for us to look inside of an app. But so if developers add this API, then we can start to say things like, when users use this particular feature, they're using far more energy. When they have this setting in your app turned on, they use far more energy, and so on. And all the feedback that we've gotten from developers tells us that there's no good way of doing this right now. And so you can imagine that now there's another box in the crowd where you have different forms of different sources of instrumentation that are going to be providing us data so we can give more fine-grained diagnosis. And from the data that we're collecting, there are a lot of interesting things that we would like to do. So one of those is to give people a sense of the potential impact of an app before they download it. So you go to an app store or you go to an app discovery tool and it says, based on what we've seen, you're running an iPhone 4S and you have this particular operating system version, and we expect that it's going to have this kind of an impact on your battery if you were to download and run this tool. And of course, there's nothing about this analysis that's specific to energy. All of those distributions that I showed you could just as easily be performance or memory usage and so on. And so we could also say something about how likely is this to slow down your device and so on. There's also nothing specific about this to mobile devices. So we've been talking with Audi about getting access to some of the diagnostics that they have built into all of their vehicles. So one of the people in our lab is building a little device that you can plug into this diagnostic port. It'll talk to your mobile device, and all of these diagnostic ports report information like your fuel consumption, your speed, tachometer, things like this. And so given that kind of information, you can start to answer some really interesting questions about how fuel is consumed in your vehicle. Compared with other people who have the same model vehicle, what distinguishes those who get much better gas mileage? What is the most fuel-efficient route from A to B, which may not be the shortest or the fastest, and so on? And then we've also started looking at body metric stuff. So compared with people who run similar distances but get better times, what distinguishes their sleeping habits, say, or why are they getting basically a better result out of their exercise or their sleep than I am? And so these are some of the apps that we're looking to develop at Kuro. And in general, something that we've seen people say is that companies have approached us basically telling us that a lot of this analysis that we're doing would be really useful for data type X that they have, where we won't be able to get access to that data, but we could provide them the statistics that we're doing as a service. So give them the ability to pipe in their data and get their results back without us having to build an app. So this is some of the stuff that we're starting to work on at Kuro Labs, and hopefully someday I'll be able to come by and give you a talk about that stuff. So as I said, some of the next steps that we have are an API for developers, building some new application domains like vehicles and body metrics. The theme here has been deploy to the crowd and diagnose in the cloud. We built this platform for collaborative diagnosis, and the first thing we applied it to was energy use on mobile devices, but we have obviously lots more stuff planned. So you can go to Kuro Labs, which right now redirects to the Carrot homepage, and you can find there, as I mentioned earlier, links to the App Store download, links to the Google Play Store download, and links to our GitHub. And that's it. I'll take questions.
So if you have a question, please step to the mic so that we can hear you.
Hello. Corey Lindenhainer at Los Alamos National Laboratory. You described a number of things that you tell people that they can do to kill off an app or restart an app or whatever. Are you able to tell them not to do things like don't upgrade to the newest version of the OS or don't drop your phone? Or?
Yeah, so we had this conversation particularly about the OS upgrade anti-recommendation. And the danger here is that if you tell someone not to upgrade to the newest version of the operating system because it might negatively impact their battery life, you're also, unfortunately, recommending that they implicitly don't install all of the security patches and so on that are probably intrinsic to that new version. And so we made a strategic decision that we'll tell people to upgrade, because that's, of course, sanctioned by whoever has released that operating system version. But we don't tell people not to upgrade because we feel like we would be taking on a kind of burden of proof that we were not willing to shoulder.
Yeah. Okay.
Alvin Couch, Tufts University. Do you have any comment on the effect of the sync settings for networked apps upon power? Because so far what I've seen from you is an overall black box power estimate for apps, but apps are configurable for aggressive or non-aggressive network traffic. Could you give us some idea of whether or not you know what's going on there and whether or not it might someday analyze that?
Right. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we were trying to go for the most invasive method that would work on both iOS and Android. And on iOS, you're not able to see the internal settings of user apps. And so we don't, on iOS, currently measure that information. We've started to measure it on Android where possible, And so we're doing some of that analysis on the back end. Certainly with a developer API, app settings, including those related to synchronization, are things that we're going to be looking at. But I don't have any results to share with you right now.
Hi, I'm Soila Kavulia from Carnegie Mellon University.
Hi, Soila.
I have a follow-up on Corey's question. So right now you're looking for apps that are running in the same sorts of platforms, but is there something that Carrot can say about the platform as a whole? So overall, maybe iOS is much better at energy management than Android.
Right. So I mean, obviously, this is a tricky question because if you just compare direct battery life, you know, they have different batteries and different hardware that they're running on. We certainly have data as far as which devices and which device models are seeing, statistically speaking, better battery life than others. Where it gets hairy is that we would also, in addition to having to account for the various hardware differences, have to say something about how different types of people use these devices. And user behavior is something that we would need more instrumentation to get a better sense of. And it's not even clear to me, at least, how you would say that one user is sort of a more of a power user than others. So I would, for example, expect that certain types of iOS users are going to consume way more power than others because they're constantly downloading things or reloading their Facebook feed, and whereas others are just sitting and reading a Kindle app with their network turned off and so on. And so factors like that, disentangling them, is something that we don't have a good sense of how to do. And so we tend not to make those blanket statements. We just sort of present the data, say. So we're working on a web page that just gives general statistics about what are the top hogs and bugs on different platforms, which devices seem to get better battery life, which operating system version, and so on and so forth. But we're just at the point of saying, this is the data. We don't have a good explanation for this yet. Because that's tough to do. Yeah.
Hey, Tim Nelson, WPI. So I've got to know, you got all of that feedback, and you said some was negative. Was any of the negative feedback actually helpful, or was it all trolling?
All negative feedback is helpful. Even really? When it's totally not based in reality. The point is that, so for example, we had negative feedback. Like if you go, you can go on the App Store and you can read the reviews that people have written. And on the latest version of the app, you have users complaining about how the graphs that we have inside of the app are confusing and they don't understand them. And the current version of the app, the version of the app that they are reviewing, doesn't have those graphs. Okay, so this is negative feedback, but it's also kind of informative. So what it's telling us is that there was some lag associated with, this just because it says it's this version doesn't mean they're actually running this version. They may be reviewing an earlier one. And we also got feedback on one of their very, actually pretty much every version of Carrot on iOS, we've gotten feedback from users saying, Carrot is using up all of my battery life because it's running GPS constantly. And this was frustrating because Carrot never runs GPS, ever, period. But the point is, it uses the location services to get a notification when you do a significant location change, which doesn't use GPS, but it does show that little icon on the top bar that makes people think that you're using GPS. It's really just meant to show location services, but in general, when you see that icon, you think that it's using GPS. So this was useful to us because then we knew that we needed to inform users better about how are we actually using location services, what is the real battery impact based on what we measured in hardware and so on. So most of the negative feedback was of that kind of form, where it was frustrating and it wasn't really something we were doing wrong, but it gave us an opportunity to find ways of communicating better. A lot of the stuff that we didn't have expertise on was like building a product and doing a UI and doing customer interaction and so on. All of us were academics, and so we cared very much about like the data and the analysis and the performance and that sort of thing, and not so much about what's the wording on this page that will most effectively communicate to this user how they should think about this data and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, Rick Farrow. Well, one of the things that struck me about this is a, like you said, an academic research project. So who pays for EC2?
Yeah, okay, so this is a good opportunity to say thank you to both the AMP Lab and to AWS. So Amazon AWS donated spectacular amounts of resources to the AMP Lab over the course of this project. So we've, for various reasons, used many, many tens of thousands of dollars of AWS resources, basically all of which were donated to the lab courtesy of AWS. So if any of you are in the building, thank you. If you're watching, thank you. It would not have been possible without those sort of donations. And obviously, moving forward, we're looking at all sorts of ways about reducing those sort of expenses. So some of the one of the reasons that it was so expensive was that we had, again, this design that was meant for two, at least, orders of magnitude fewer users than what we actually encountered.
Right.
And so taking the time to redo everything on the back end is just, you know, we're resource constrained.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
Hello. Thanks for your presentation. I thought it was very interesting. David Sobel from MIT. I just had a question. At the beginning, you mentioned that you went through great pains to remove any personally identifiable information from users. And I was just wondering if you could discuss the details of that a little bit more. And, you know, as a general question, how much personally identifiable information is generally available to mobile app developers? I'm assuming everything, but if you can just comment on that.
Sure. So there were two forms of personal data that we decided not to gather. So one was the personal data that the users would provide explicitly. So we decided not to have, for example, you know, sign up for this service, provide us with an email address, and so on. We said, we're going to generate a random ID, and that's how you're going to be identified, and there'll be no way to trace it back to your name, for example. The other kind of sort of private data that we wanted to make sure that we were not recording on the back end was, for instance, if you're an app developer and you are running some experimental app on your device, this will show up in the process list. And we were contacted by a couple of developers who had apps where the name of the app, the name of the process alone, was something that they didn't want to be leaked. And so in order to deal with this, essentially, if we get reports on the back end of an app that we only see running on some fewer than five devices was the threshold that we set. If we see it running on fewer than five devices, then we don't include it in the analysis, and after some number of days, it gets dropped. And so this was another form of private information. You've seen probably news stories about apps that would, for example, ask for access to the address book and then communicate the address book and so on. I think Path was one that got in trouble for doing this. There's an argument to be made that knowing something about, for example, how social this user is could say something potentially about how they're using Facebook and so on. So you'd always make an argument for collecting a certain type of data. But anytime it was personally identifying, we said we're just not going to do it. Yeah.
Any more?
Thank you. Cool. Thanks.